showers in the afternoon, humid highs in the upper 70s. This is WJFF Jeffersonville. From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the unemployment cliff. Millions of Americans are set to lose benefits next month. SUNY Sullivan economics professor Art Riegel tells us what to expect. The Sorceress of Stitch, Christy Johnson, talks to WJFF's Jesse Sposato about her new book, Mystical Stitches, Embroidery for Personal Empowerment and Magical Embellishment. We'll talk with director Todd Stevens about his new film, Swan Song, starring veteran actor Udo Kier, and opening next week at the Calicoon Theater, plus that preview of tonight's final Sunset Pavilion concert at the Chandelier Music Festival. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. The Taliban co-founder Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar is in the Afghan capital of Kabul today for talks on forming a new Afghan government. He's the most senior Taliban leader now in Afghanistan and the man who signed the agreement with the U.S. that led to the American withdrawal. The BBC's Dan Johnson has details.
It's another sign of the Taliban's confidence that they have control of the country, that they can move freely and move even their most senior figures now into position in Kabul to start talks about what the next form of government will actually be. The Taliban has said that it wants to reach out to some other groups. Some of them will be considered extremist Islamist groups like the Haqqani Network. We saw some of their figures in Kabul yesterday, perhaps ready for talks, but also reaching out to more moderate figures like the former president, Hamid Karzai. The Taliban says it wants to form an inclusive government that will represent everybody in Afghanistan.
The Taliban has sought to present a more moderate face since the takeover, but there have been reports of reprisals against those who aided U.S. and NATO troops. The U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan advising Americans not to travel to the Kabul airport unless they've been given instructions to do so from a U.S. government representative. The embassy issued a new advisory today citing potential security threats. Crowds remain outside the airport as Afghan translators and others who aided the U.S. are seeking evacuation for themselves and their families. College and university students in Nevada now among those who will have to provide proof of COVID-19 vaccination to attend on-campus classes in 2022. From member station KNPR in Las Vegas, Nicole Robinson Carroll reports.
The State Board of Health voted unanimously following hours of contentious public comments. Doug Unger with the Nevada Faculty Alliance assured vaccine-hesitant students they will not be left behind.
Those of you who do not want to take the vaccine can be accommodated in remote and online classes until such time as you are comfortable getting vaccinated or the community health emergency has waned enough so that in-person class attendance without being vaccinated is safe once more.
Under the new policy, students must be vaccinated by November 1st to register for spring 2022 classes. For NPR News, I'm Nicole Robinson Carroll in Las Vegas.
New England is preparing for what could be the region's first direct hurricane landfall in 30 years. National Hurricane Center's Andy Latto says Tropical Storm Henri will likely gain hurricane status later today.
It's going to be moving north-northeast throughout today and approaching the New England area or Long Island, probably by Sunday afternoon.
Hurricane watches and warnings have been posted for Long Island, as well as Connecticut and Massachusetts. Hurricane Grace, meanwhile, made a second landfall in Mexico today. This is NPR News. San Francisco is now the first major city in the nation to require proof of full vaccination against COVID-19 for people to dine inside restaurants, work out in gyms, or attend indoor concerts. And restaurant customer Russ Sherman says it's a good thing.
I think it's terrific, actually. Absolutely in favor of it. My wife is a physician, so she sees a lot of COVID. She sees the spiking going on.
The proof of vaccination requirement went into effect yesterday. Restaurants and bars have posted signs and added extra staff to verify their customer status. Conductor Michael Morgan, the longtime music director of the Oakland Symphony, has died of a severe infection after having received a kidney transplant in May. He was 63 years old. Morgan was a passionate advocate for music education, as Jeff London reports.
The Washington, D.C. native showed his prodigious gifts at an early age, playing piano and conducting the D.C. Youth Orchestra. He attended Oberlin Conservatory and studied under Leonard Bernstein and Seiji Ozawa at Tanglewood. One of very few African-American conductors, Morgan appeared with the New York Philharmonic, St. Louis Symphony, Chicago Symphony, and Vienna Opera, among others, before taking a job in Oakland. While there, he also conducted the Oakland Youth Orchestra, San Francisco Symphony, and was an active presence in Oakland's public schools. Morgan's health had been failing in recent years. He went on dialysis and, after a 7-year wait, had a kidney transplant this spring. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan. Thanking the people who make public radio great every day, and also those who listen. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. More than 7 million Americans are set to lose their unemployment aid immediately after Labor Day, even as the Delta variant poses new challenges to the economic recovery. After COVID-19 hit in March of 2020, normal unemployment payouts more than doubled in size as the federal government rapidly approved pandemic-related relief for U.S. workers being laid off by the millions. Gig workers and other unemployed Americans receiving that aid through these programs created for the pandemic will see those checks end on September 7th, along with the $300 weekly federal supplement to traditional jobless benefits. So what does it mean now that most of those programs are ending, and how will it impact workers, businesses, and the economy? We turn to SUNY Sullivan economics professor Art Riegel for some answers.
All the federal, the extended, the extra money or extended weeks programs, and these unemployment programs have two components. It's money and it's time, right? So they're extended weeks over and above what you're entitled to begin with. And then in terms of the COVID relief, there's extended money, and this is up to about $300. So let's say if you're a New York resident and you're getting the maximum unemployment, that's about $500, a little over $500 a week, all right? You add $300 a week on that for the extended benefits. You're getting a little bit over $800 a week. So that was the standard CARES, you know, the unemployment, the federal unemployment plus your New York benefit amount, if you're getting the maximum, right? If you're getting the maximum. Federal government extended that money, that $300 on top, through September, right? It was supposed to end in March. They extended it through September. So that's where we are now. And the reason they did that is the data says that, for example, the New York job market, they added, in New York State, we added 44,000 jobs in July alone. And the labor curve, the labor demand curve and labor supply curve they are widely apart. There are a lot of jobs out there that the labor, you know, demanders, the employers are, you know, they're just going begging. And the labor suppliers, the employees, who can work or want to work, we're sort of just taking many are taking a laid back, you know, wait and see. And there's a couple of components to that. You can't just paint everybody with the same brush. Some are afraid still. They're working on that fear of, I don't know if I want to go back, know with a bunch of people. Some are like a couple I recently spoke to, you know, they're both getting the maximum. They were getting over $6,000 a month. They were spending time with their kids. I saw them and they were out and they said, yeah, we'll go back. We'll go back after it ends in September. And then point blank, I mean, this was nothing, they felt that, you know, if the benefit was there, they were going to take advantage of it. In economics, we call this, one of the principles is, people respond to incentives. All right. So unlike the crash of 2008, when we had to have this unemployment as a safety net, and unlike 2020 or even in the beginning of 2021, where, again, we had to have this as a safety net. When a benefit goes from a safety net to an incentive not to do something, then the government has to look at that as a policy, just as a policy decision, say, you know, what are we doing here? Are we hurting in the long run an economy? And is this sustainable? So I think they were probably, and I'm of two minds of extending it from March. Some economists said absolutely not. You know, we have increased GDP 6% first quarter, estimated 6% in the second quarter. But I'm of the mind that I said, wait, think about the families with kids. If you have kids home under normal circumstances in a normal summer, you're struggling to find, you know, childcare while you're still working through the summer. So I thought, you know, if this, looking at this pandemic and looking at all the stress it caused, you know, wait till September. Wait till September, kids are going back to school, and then now, you know, reduce that, tailor it off. And one of the things out there in the other world is, oh, all unemployment is going to stop. That's not true. These are only the extended benefits.
Right.
If you're still eligible for New York State unemployment insurance, you're going to get those benefits.
As you mentioned, the government trying to decide what to do, and it was extended through September. Now President Biden is encouraging some states with high jobless rates, which could include New York in that category, even though there was an upswing, it looks like, last month, to extend those benefits because of what's going on with the Delta variant of the coronavirus. And how do you feel about that? What's your view there?
Well, here's my view. The data in terms of unemployment statistics in New York indicate that, at least upstate, we're almost back to pre-pandemic levels. You know, we're at 4% in some counties, 5%, which in terms of unemployment statistics and the unemployment rate is not a bad rate. You never want it to be zero. That's a good rate to work with. Now, in New York City, it's higher. New York City, they have an extended lockdown. They have much more restrictions on their economy, but that's still coming down. In terms of the Delta variant, one of the other things that the government considered is the extended, when they extended it, and I agreed with, is the vaccination rollout. So this gave plenty, a lot more time for people to get vaccinated through the summer, right, to vaccinate more of our population. So we're at a point where if you want the vaccine, you can get it. You can get it any way you want it, right? That wasn't the fact in January, February, March, April. So in terms of the Delta variant, the latest data that's come out is that the vaccines are effective against the Delta, though you might need a booster. And so when it... And I just look at data. I don't look at left, right, Democrat, Republican. I'm looking at unemployment statistics in all the counties outside of New York City, and they are now low, very low and manageable. I'm looking at unemployment statistics in New York City, though, that they've come down, but they're still probably around 9%, which is still high. So what you do with that, I'm not sure. But in terms of the Delta variant, the bottom line is we need to look at this thing and say, we're never getting rid of, like, we can't get rid of the flu. So the best way to deal with this is, and it's my opinion, I'm not speaking for the radio station or Sullivan County Community College, right? But, get vaccinated, and like you would with anything else, and follow through with if they find out that the booster is better to increase your resistance against Delta. If there are particular types of vaccine that are better against Delta, then we need to look at that. But constantly paying to have people home and not work and take these jobs that are going begging is unsustainable over the long term.
Well, that's been the criticism of business owners and Republican lawmakers specifically as well, blaming the supplements for the difficulties that restaurants and retailers and other employers in our region have faced filling jobs all spring and summer. So do you think that with these expiring, that will help those folks? Because there are people still looking for workers, and they're still paying sign-on bonuses, and they're still curtailing hours because they don't have enough people to help.
Oh, yeah. I know restaurants have been in business for years that shut down an extra week, a day a week, or 2 days a week. And you'll see, they'll post, you know, we have a labor shortage. We don't have enough people to even wait your table or anything else.
So with these incentives ending, do you think that that means more people are going to be out there and able to fill those jobs?
I do, but there's another issue in terms of service jobs. This pause gave a lot of people time to think about, do I want to go back to an industry that doesn't really honor my work? You know, in the United States, we look down on we don't, not look down, but we don't consider waiting tables, quote unquote, to be a life's work. Where if you go to Europe, that's a profession. You can wait tables for 30 years, have benefits and a good salary, and you're looked upon as having a profession. So that's part of that. The other part is wages, you know, were traditionally very low. You were paid sub-minimum and, you know, and then dependent upon tips. But that's changing. And actually, the pandemic did change that. I've noticed that the wages paid as a base wage for service folks have increased. So that's actually a good thing. The other side of that, though, is they're still going begging. So now you have to ask, well, if we covered one variable, you know, low wages, now what's the other variable? And the other variable could very well be these extra payments. Now I was talking to, I'd love to talk to people in the grocery store and the post office and all, and pick their brains on their particular experiences. And I was talking to some parents whose adult children are in the service business, and they said they're making money hand over fist because of the labor shortage, because the restaurants that they're working in can't find as many people. They're working more shifts. Their tips are, you know, they're making $300 and $400 a night in some of these places here in Sullivan County.
Oh, wow.
So I mean, because again, labor supply curve versus labor demand curve. It's a web, Tim. It's several different reasons. I don't think you can put it all on the extended benefits, but certainly the extended benefits, again, incentives are part of it. Again, when it goes from a safety net issue to an incentive issue, that of I'm helping you to survive this crisis to now you're getting this payment, but you really can go back to work because there's all this work available. And there's one other thing I saw a couple days ago. Somebody thought that they knew a lot about employment law, was recommending on social media to force your employer to fire you if you didn't want to get the vaccination. So then you would get unemployment benefits. Let me just state, that is absolutely not true.
No.
If you don't want to take the vaccination, but your particular employer says this is a policy for everybody, right? You can quit, absolutely. But if you're terminated, you can't just automatically be eligible for benefits because you were fired for cause for violating company policy. Now, that might go into the courts, and that might still be worked out because the FDA hasn't approved many of these medications yet. You might be able to get around it with a medical exemption if you can prove that medical exemption. But for the record, some of the stuff you see on the internet, just, you know, obviously you don't want to listen to and take to heart.
The other aspect of the benefits ending could mean spending coming down because this has been cash in people's pockets, too. Is that something that you're looking at as well?
Yep, that could very well happen short term, but in the long term, even within a couple of months, remember that spending is going to that money coming in is going to be taken place by money that you're going to earn. That these folks can very well go out and earn in the marketplace. I would say it's a different situation than we had after the crash of 08 through 09 and through 10, where the federal government had these extra programs. Or 2020 when the pandemic hit. Again, I always look at the data and I look at unemployment rates and I look at jobs added and I say, all right, what are the variables here? And at this particular point, that spending from the unemployment benefit will simply be swapped out with spending from work, spending from getting a job and going back into the workforce. So, you know, there could be a blip, and I would be very interested to see the data on that in terms of spending patterns within the next quarter. Well, not the next quarter, probably last quarter would show up, quarter four, Q4 of 2021. I'd be very interested to see that, you know, next year, see how we come out with that. But I think the time is right now. You know, kids are back in school. Jobs are plentiful. We have to, at some point, get back to some sense of normalcy, although I don't think that we'll ever be what we were, you know, pre-pandemic in terms of our attitudes on work and whatnot and our technology on being able to work remotely, which is another issue affecting employment, which, you know, that's a whole other story on the employees saying, look, I've become comfortable working remotely. I'm not one collecting unemployment. I'm working for you, right? But I've been able to spend more time with my kids. I've been able to flex my work around my family and not the other way around. Can you keep me if I work on site 2 days a week and off site 3 days a week? Or there are these constant negotiations going on. And sometimes that's yes, and sometimes that's no. And so there's some frictional unemployment. We call frictional unemployment. People are jumping jobs. You know, they're leaving one and finding another one to better suit their needs because they found out that they can actually be mobile, you know, nomads and work remotely.
Yeah.
So that's going to be the data coming out from that and years to come will be very interesting in the workplace.
And that'll be our follow-up interview.
Great.
All right. Art Riegel, professor of economics at SUNY Sullivan. Art, thanks for shedding some light on this, and we will be in touch.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll meet the Sorceress of Stitch.
I'm Donna Fellenberg, host of Catskill Character. I hope you'll join me and my guest, Pastor Sung Jin Hong of the United Methodist Church of Grahamsville and Sundown. What role does the church play in the community today? How does a young man from South Korea decide to become a pastor and end up in the Catskills? Find out this Saturday at 11:30 on Catskill Character on WJFF.
I'm Silvia Poggioli. You probably imagine me cruising around Roma in a Ferrari convertible. Ha! Try a 2006 Toyota Corolla with a missing side view mirror. Whatever you drive, when it's time to part with it, donate it to us. You'll get a tax break and we'll tow it away for free. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Donate now at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Christy Johnson's art combines cosmic visions, botanicals, and symbols stitched slowly and methodically into fabric. Her new book, Mystical Stitches, Embroidery for Personal Empowerment and Magical Embellishment, combines the beloved and accessible craft of embroidery with a spiritual element. WJFF's Jesse Spisato spoke to her about the book and her work on the latest dove on the Sullivan County Dove Trail.
I wanted to start by talking about your book, Mystical Stitches, which came out in June. First of all, congratulations. It's so beautiful.
Well, thank you.
You talked a little bit in one of your Instagram stories about the journey sort of leading up to the creation of the book, how it took 10 years and began with you making those hand embroidered song lyric pieces, which were super cute. I was wondering, like, what was the impetus for making those in the first place? Why embroidery? Why song lyrics?
Right. That's a really good question. I think it was just in a time in my life when I was kind of trying to find my footing as an artist, like trying to find where I became an individual in what I was working on, especially because I studied fashion at an art school. And so I was exposed to sort of art as a concept, as a sort of greater goal in the world and everything, but I wasn't necessarily, because I studied fashion, it was very much like you have a concept for your collection and you, you know, that collection needs to be sold.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think, embroidery for me was sort of like a way of, finding a form of expression that felt a little more unique to me. And within sort of the art world, trying to figure out, a way, cause I had studied painting in when I was in high school. I went to a magnet art school. I was doing painting there. So I had a lot of sort of experience with, you know, that sort of field, but painting never really felt like my trajectory. And so embroidery was this beautiful way of kind of mixing those two worlds, mixing the world of fashion and the world of art, and just allowing them to continue to exist together, I guess. Yeah.
That's cool. How did you wind up working on embroidery with clothing eventually?
Right. I had made a few pieces of my own, you know, for my own clothes. The first sort of step of making embroidery on clothing was the person who I was working for approached me after I was working on these embroidered song lyrics. And he asked, he was like, hey, do you want to do, you know, do you want to make some designs? Cause we had worked together for many years by that point. I think we had been working together for like 3 or 4 years at that point. And so we knew each other. He knew my working style. He knew my art, and was really supportive of that. And he said, you know, I want to make these denim shirts that are made in the USA, and you know, that sort of vintage denim that, and like chambray that just feels really nice. But I want to embroider them and have a little more psychedelic, a little bit more 70s style embroidery. And he actually referenced the book Native Funk and Flash. And I don't know if I had ever seen that book before that moment, but that was a big part of what his inspiration for it was. And that I was like, that's, you know, I've always been really into 70s art and 70s sort of counterculture clothes and everything. And so I was like, yes, absolutely. So that was kind of how I got started with embroidering on clothes, I guess, was really kind of being invited to.
That's awesome. I mean, it seems like such a natural trajectory anyway, like given that you went to fashion school and stuff, and then you found like your medium. I was interested in one of the first pages of your book is a collection of sort of all the embroidery thread that's been ripped out, demonstrating, you know, that you've made a bunch of mistakes along the way, which I loved. Why was that important for you to share with your readers?
Because I think that there's a lot of times like the reaction that I'll get to a lot of my work is like, oh, you know, I would love to try embroidery, but I'm just not that good at it. And I'm like, neither am I all the time, you know? And it felt like that was really important, especially as, you know, we live in this culture where we see a lot of the end results, but we don't see a lot of the process. And so introducing that concept of just like, I made a lot of mistakes. I restitched one of the flower pages. I think I restitched it 3 or 4 times before I finally, and I went to the point of cutting out stitches, restitching it. And then I just scrapped the thing, you know, all of probably 2 days worth of work on this piece before getting to the final piece. And that was just one page of, I don't know how many pages are in the Sybil's library, but one page of many, 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 many. So yeah, just kind of encouraging people to be okay with the idea that it's not going to turn out right the first time.
Yeah, that's really encouraging. It's so true. The process is so much messier than what we see in the end, usually.
Yeah. And as a teacher, it's, you know, there's a lot of like, oh, it doesn't look right yet. And I'm like, of course it doesn't look right yet. You're learning and, you know, encouraging that the embracing of that aspect of learning. And it's okay for things to not turn out right. And maybe you don't even need to rip them out. Maybe it just like goes into a pile. For me, like, you know, a lot of these pieces that I make that didn't necessarily turn out the way that I wanted to, they'll end up in a pile that I'll pull them out of that pile 6 years later and be like, oh, this is perfect to like patch into some quilt or something like that. And so I think all of these things sort of start to piece themselves together as, you know, these failures. And just like in life where we see like the failures, the things that went horribly wrong in our mind, we can look back on a lot of times and be like, oh, I'm actually really glad that that happened. Otherwise life could have turned out like, maybe I wouldn't have been as appreciative, or I wouldn't have really understood what was at stake, or, you know, having so much more of a broader viewpoint of things, we can understand that our failures actually feed us. So yeah, having that be a big part of the book felt really important.
Yeah, that's such a nice like way to look at life in general, I feel like. Good lesson.
Totally.
In your book, you write that it's more than simply a series of, you know, projects to complete. Can you talk a little bit more about the like spiritual aspect to Mystical Stitches?
Yeah. So for me, embroidery becomes this beautiful way of really slowing down. Like embroidery in its own, in the act of embroidery, is a meditation. Because you have to really focus. I mean, you can technically watch TV while you embroider. I have watched movies embroidering, you know, doesn't exist outside of that. But I do think that, being able to take that opportunity to really sit and focus on something that works so slowly compared to what we're used to the rate that we're used to things happening at. And so being able to take that time and allow it to be sort of a mental and emotional processing, as well as sort of intention setting and deciding the way that things do get to be. And a lot of the times I will take an embroidery and a design as an opportunity to work through a concept or work through, you know, something that I want to work towards. And that is not to say that I'm just sitting there the whole time being like, things are going to be great. And, you know, life is going to be beautiful. Like, I think it's really important to note that a lot of the times, you know, because the embroidery process takes so long, a lot of like negative stuff comes up and I'm like, oh, maybe I'm not good enough, or maybe that's not meant for me, or this or that. And I think that's just as important to the process, to any sort of intention setting or any sort of guidance that we're trying to find and move towards in our lives. I think it's really important to be allowed to bring those emotions up. And I think that the actual physicality of embroidery, where we're literally taking a needle and thread up through the fabric and then bringing it back down underneath the fabric, and we've got this sort of like everything that we're seeing on the surface, and then an entirely different visual on the backside of it, sort of the underside, the working side of it. And I think that that kind of allows itself to be a little bit of a metaphor for what we are actually working with in our own minds as well, where we've got, you know, what we desire and what we want that seems to make all sorts of perfect sense on the front side. But then we're working with a lot of stuff that's underneath it all. And it's kind of like, well, you know, maybe we need to kind of work with that a little bit too. So.
Wow. Like you said, that is just like, there's so many metaphors here for life. It's amazing. It's also like such a good reminder that meditation can come in so many forms. Like it doesn't have to just mean like sitting down with your meditation app or whatever, which is awesome. But like, that's not the only thing that meditation means, you know, like it could look like this, which is really cool. This is my last question about the book. Who do you imagine it to be for? Like, is it for people who already have some level of experience with embroidery, or do you think it can be for beginners as well?
I think it could definitely be for beginners as well. I tried to include everything like from the very basics of the materials. but there are a few details like that I think, you know, watching a video or seeing somebody experience it in person, like how do I hold the hoop? Or, you know, there's a few things sort of, especially like as I consider it after writing the book, it's like, oh, I didn't mention like how to tie off a thread. You know, there's little details like that. But I do think that I did design it for beginners. I tried to make the stitch instructions as clear as possible, because that's something that I find really difficult to understand, where I'm like, oh, in this one illustration, the stitcher has created three different motions, but they didn't tell me that. Like, I didn't know that this was going to take three passes. And so I tried to, as clearly as possible, illustrate the stitches so that you, like, your needle's going in here and it's coming out here, so that there was more of a full understanding for people who hadn't had any experience stitching before.
That's great. That makes me feel like I could actually read your book and follow along.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did like a whole series of videos for how to do each stitches that are free on my website, because I wanted to be able to offer that for people as well, to kind of like, okay, it's one thing to read something in a book, but some skills, especially when there is like sort of a movement involved, like watching a video of it is sort of like, oh, okay.
Wow. Yeah. That seems super helpful. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about some Sullivan County things as well. You painted the latest dove on the Sullivan Catskills Dove Trail, which is really exciting. That's such a fun thing, I feel like, to be a part of. What was that experience like? And how did you decide what to paint?
I just really thought about, I mean, this time of the year is as, you know, the best time of the year to ask me about living in Sullivan County.
You know.
Although, I mean, I actually really do love winter, and I love the quietness of, you know, being under a few feet of snow. But the way that I decided is just like sort of what is surrounding me that I'm inspired by, and the natural world is, and it was working with, you know, one of the most beautiful parts I find about this area, is all of the bodies of water, and, you know, being able to always kind of being within like an arm's reach of a river or a lake or something. And sort of seeing it driving around, always having these beautiful sunset lake views. And so that was a big part, is sort of like sunset, water, and the garden. And so there's a little grouping of flowers sort of emerging out of the rushing waters. So, yeah.
Awesome. I can't wait to see it. That sounds so fun. And I also feel like, yeah, all the water, bodies of water here are definitely one of my favorite things about Sullivan County, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of touched on this, but, you know, lastly, like, you teach workshops here, and obviously you created your book here. What makes Sullivan County a great place to actually make your art?
For me, I think it feels very grounding here. Like, there are a lot of things that are just really encouraging stillness and encouraging slowness, you know, not needing to be rushing through the day. From, you know, I live right around a bunch of farms, and so there's a lot of trucks kind of going, farm trucks going slowly by the house every day. And there's, I can see cows down the road, and there's just this, there's always this feeling of just like nothing needs to happen immediately. Like, we are all like doing what we need to do and making sure that that happened, like making sure we're getting done what we need done. But it just feels like there is a sort of embrace of that, the lifestyle of, like, you know, it's okay that you don't have, you know, every single store that you could possibly imagine at an arm's reach. And it's okay that places close at 5, and it's okay that things are not open during the week some of the times. I really like the way that it feels like this area really encourages just sort of an embrace of that sort of natural state of things, the natural speed and the natural evolution of the way that the seasons evolve, is another part that I love about Sullivan County. Is I grew up in Florida, so I didn't really know much about snow or anything. I was like, wow, that actually, the feeling of having, you know, 4 months of the year where kind of nothing can get done, there's no ability, you know, we're just throwing wood into the wood stove for 4 months. And it really, it's really, what's the word for it? Sort of nourishing, I guess, having that time to kind of go back inside, stay inside. And anytime you do go outside, everything's really silent. You know, I go outside to let the chickens out, and it's just, everything's really still and quiet. And that feels really, yeah, it feels really nourishing.
Totally. Yeah. I feel like you're making me excited for the winter, like, just to get back to work in a way that, yeah, like, it's hard to do now, you know?
Yeah. And I always think, like, if I, you know, I love gardening and I love growing flowers and things, but I wonder, like, would I do it all year round if I had the option to? Like, is it such an intense part of my summer because that's the only time of the year that I can actually grow anything outside?
Yeah. I think so. That's what my feeling is, for sure. Well, this has been so awesome to chat. Thank you so much for talking to me. Cool. I'm really just looking forward to seeing your Dove and checking out your book further.
Yeah, go ahead and check it out. Yeah, it's definitely for beginners. So if you want to, if you're feeling intimidated by it, just spend some time with it, you know, take some deep breaths. That's what I always say. That's what I always do when I'm learning something new from a book. I'm just like, okay, I'm going to give myself an hour to just try and understand the initial concept here. So yeah.
That's great advice. Well, thanks again, Christy. Talk to you soon.
That's WJFF's Jesse Spisato speaking with artist Christy Johnson. You can find more about Christy and her work at her website, mixedcolor.net. And that Dove she painted will be installed at Radio Catskill's new Liberty Studio location. We hope to unveil it just before Labor Day, if it ever stops raining. We'll keep you posted. After a short break, we'll come back with a conversation with director Todd Stevens about his new film, Swan Song. This is Radio Catskill.
Get here from something old, something new. Join me Sunday night at 7 for the finale of Chandelier Week on Radio Catskill. We'll hear the Alethea Piano Trio's Sunset Pavilion Concert, along with a conversation with their cellist, Juliette Erlin. Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In the new film Swan Song, Mr. Pat is an elderly man who once owned the most fabulous hair salon in his small Midwestern town and is now living in a nursing home with his glory days behind him. He receives word that one of his former clients has died with a stipulation in her will that only he can do her hair and makeup for her funeral. He escapes from the rest home and sets out on an odyssey across his hometown of Sandusky, Ohio, reliving his glory days and discovering just how much it's changed. I spoke with the film's writer and director, Todd Stevens, who now lives in our listening area.
I know that you grew up in Ohio. This is set in Ohio. How did this story come about for you? You wrote it, you directed it, produced it. Where did this story come from?
This story comes from being inspired by this man that named Mr. Pat Pitzenbarger that I used to see around my hometown growing up as a little pre-gay boy, pre-queer boy. And he was really flamboyant, and the town was pretty conservative. And so he was a person that really stood out and was very different. And I felt very different, so I really related to him. And years later, when I got up the courage to go to my small town gay bar, which was called the Universal Fruit and Nut Company, when I walked in, I saw something sparkling on the dance floor, and I turned, and there was Pat, you know, this man that I had seen around town growing up, and I felt like I was home, you know, like I felt like I had found my tribe. And so, yeah, that I wrote the film as sort of a love letter to all the small town hairdressers, florists, interior decorators from the 60s, 70s, 80s that really had the courage to be themselves long before that was really even safe.
Had you met Mr. Pat, or how did you base this story in the film on him?
I had met him a few times, you know, back when I was younger. I never got to know him very well. I knew his lover David Moore, and David told me lots of stories about Pat. And then years later, when I went to write this film, I did a lot of research by interviewing his sister, his nieces and nephews, and his friends, the ones that are still alive. A lot of them actually died of AIDS back in the day. But so I really got a lot of inspiration from them, and sort of took it and kind of created this, you know, the actual plot is like fictitious, but the person I tried to sort of capture as much as I could based on his reality.
The plot is taking this man out of his retirement to do one last job. Can you explain to folks what that last job is?
Yeah, the last job is, so he's been in a nursing home for about 7 years and has pretty much given up on life, just kind of existing. And one day a lawyer comes and says that one of his top clients has just passed away, and that she specified in her will that he do her hair and makeup for the funeral. And that top client is Linda Evans from Dynasty. And, you know, that's who's playing the part of Rita Parker Sloan in the film. And Pat is really, they had a falling out and haven't spoken in many years. So he's very conflicted as to whether he wants to do the job or not.
Pat is played in the film by Udo Kier, and he's been receiving wonderful reviews, as the film has. How did you come to cast him in the role?
It was a really hard role to cast. We spent like more than a year and a half, you know, talking to various people, and people came on and didn't work out or whatever. But over time, I realized that for this particular film, I really wanted all the queer parts to be played by queer actors. And when you look up queer in the dictionary, Udo Kier comes up. No, I'm just kidding. I've always admired Udo from the Andy Warhol movies, Frankenstein and Dracula he did way back in the day, up through things like My Own Private Idaho, which is one of my favorite films. And he's really incredible in the film. Working with him was, I felt like every day I was watching like a master class in acting. We've become really close friends, which actually we had known each other for about a year before we shot, and we were sort of friends going into it. So that really helped that sort of actor-director relationship, that we really knew each other and really trusted each other by the time we shot the film.
There's an image of him in the green jazzy, I guess, that it matches his suit, and he's got his fedora, and I don't know if he has a cigarette in his hand, but it looks like it's up in that direction. It's just such this iconic photo of this man with no fear, and he even says in the New York Times interview that he had no fear in this role. How was that for you, having someone being so brave to just dive right in?
It was wonderful. I mean, you know, it's a pretty low budget film, so we didn't have trailers and fancy, you know, all the fancy things that a lot of stars are used to. But Udo is from the indie school, you know, he actually loves that environment. So it was a rough shoot. I mean, it was shot in 18 days, and we were shooting in Sandusky, Ohio, in the middle of summer, which is very hot and humid. Sometimes it got up over 100, and Udo was in either like a gray sweatpants outfit and sweatshirt, or a sort of pistachio green polyester pantsuit. And it was hot, you know, but he never complained. We never had to look for him, like, where's Udo? He's in the trailer kind of thing. I mean, as I said, there was no trailer, but he's sort of playing a diva, but he had the opposite of a diva attitude. So, it was a joy to work with him. And he really was like always, you know, on the front line saying, let's shoot, let's go.
In the New York Times also, they mentioned that this is your Ohio trilogy, which began with Edge of 17 in 1998 and Gypsy 83 in 2001. Do you see this as part of that kind of finishing this trilogy of men or gay men who built a life in Ohio?
I think so. I mean, for now, you know, it's interesting because the two of the films are based on this queer bar, the Fruit Nut Company, which was a real place. And, you know, a lot of those places in small towns are closing as it becomes more, you know, okay to be who you are in public, hold your boyfriend's hand, kiss your husband. You know, we could never do that back in the day. So we needed places like the Fruit Nut to be safe and to be ourselves. It's even in my hometown, it's completely different now. I mean, there's pride flags flying all year long. And that's happening not everywhere, but in a lot of places. So I guess, you know, that's why these small town gay bars are going out of business. That and technology and COVID certainly didn't help. But it was kind of a trend even happening before then. So I'm not sure. Yeah, the gay community in my town has like assimilated into the rest of society for the most part. So I'm not sure. Maybe there's something to say in that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I've said what I needed to say for now.
Well, now the film comes to another small town, the Calicoon Theater. Maybe in the past that might be something controversial, this film playing in town, but now it just seems part of the norm. And how does it feel to you to have the film in your own backyard? It's right here, down here on Upper Main Street in Little Calicoon.
I know. It's incredible. Chrissy, who runs the theater, is amazing, and I think I love that theater so much.
It's a great theater.
I mean, I live on the PA side, not far from Calicoon in Damascus, PA, so we've got some Wayne County pride going here. But that's where I go and see all my movies, pretty much. And I'm able to do that because she pretty much programs all the films that I want to see. And that's a real gift that we have here, you know. So it's just such an honor. I drove by. I went to PEX to go to the grocery store, and I saw Swan Song, you know, coming next on the marquee. And it's just moments like that are such a big honor, you know, because it's like I said, that's my home. You know, this is my home now. And so, yeah, I'm just thrilled.
Well, also sort of brings full circle what you were talking about before when you're growing up and how life has changed. And so it must be even more meaningful to you to see that your own film on that marquee in this home.
Absolutely. And it also played, I was home in, you know, home in Sandusky last week. And it's playing there in the Cinemark multiplex that I grew up watching movies at behind the mall, what's left of the mall, and you know that was amazing too. I mean, that's where it really hit home that how much times have changed and just how the community came out and supported the film. You know, they supported the film during production so much. I mean, the end credits are pretty long because we had to like thank so many people who donated things and gave us locations and props and, you know, worked as extras and all that. But it's really, times really have changed. And, you know, sometimes you can go home again. And I felt like that was the case here.
Will there be a sort of an Oscar campaign, do you think, for Udo or the film itself, or do you hit other festivals? What's happening next with the film?
Well, the film, you know, was released theatrically. It's still playing in about 50 cities, I think. It was released in the theaters a couple weeks ago. This past Friday, it went up on demand, you know, so you can rent it or buy it on iTunes or on Amazon or all those other streaming services. We're just like getting it out there. Oscar campaign. I mean, I have no idea, you know, that it's a small film. We have an amazing distributor, Magnolia Pictures. But we're small, you know, so Oscar campaigns are usually done by require like tons and tons of money. So I'm not sure that that's going to happen, but I wish that it would for Udo because when I was watching him act, I was like, this guy deserves an Oscar for this, you know, but it's such a long shot with a small film.
And what's next for you? Are you taking a break or are you working on another project?
Right now I'm kind of staring at the window and just trying to kind of like come down from all the buzz, glamour that I've been traveling a lot. So it's really great to be back here and back home. But I'm developing a TV show that I'm going to try to sell called Flamingos, which is about a gay retirement home set in Florida.
Fantastic.
So kind of picking up on some of the themes from Swan Song, you know, it's never too late to live your best life. I've written a part for Udo that's really fun, and also for Jennifer Coolidge and some of the other people that were involved in this film and past films that I've done. We'll see how it goes.
Todd Stevens, the writer, producer, director of Swan Song, opening at the Calicoon Theater Wednesday and also playing Thursday. Todd, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Todd Stevens will be at both screenings of the film at the Calicoon Theater this coming Wednesday and Thursday for an audience talkback. And we've been featuring concerts from the Chandelier Music Festival all week on Radio Catskill. Tonight is the final concert at the Sunset Pavilion. It's an evening of chamber music featuring the Alethea Piano Trio. We'll have that tomorrow on Sunday Stage at 7 p.m. if you missed the concert tonight or if you want to catch it again. Our classical music host, Kit, spoke with the trio's cellist, Juliette Erlen.
I was born in a family of musicians and from France. And I was really early on very attracted to the cello. I think my mom was playing with a cellist at the time. She's a pianist. And so when I was 3 and a half, I asked to start cello. I was told I was a little too small, so I had to wait a year. So I started when I was 4 and a half. And just really early on discovered the joy of chamber music because my sister was playing the violin. So chamber music has always been a passion of mine, and that's why I'm so happy to be part of a trio and with wonderful colleagues, Francesca and Fefe. So I was born into this family, and it just was a bit of a... I knew really early that I wanted to be a professional musician. I don't know if it's because I was born into it, but it was kind of an obvious choice for me, and I went to a special school for musicians since I was 8.
Uh-huh.
And then at the age of 16, I entered the Paris Conservatory, so I was getting my bachelor while finishing my high school degree, which was a little challenging at times. So I did my undergrad and master's at the Paris Conservatory. And then in the final year of my master's, I wanted to get an opportunity to study in the U.S., and I met this great professor, Richard Aaron. So I went to the U.S. first as an exchange student, and then really liked it and decided to stay and pursued my studies at the Juilliard School, and then got my doctorate at the University of Southern California. And now I'm starting, just joined the faculty of TCU.
So, and are you all the members of the trio based in the same city? I mean, I've been talking to some groups where they're kind of scattered all over, and that seems like that would make it really difficult.
So the trio is based in New York. Francesca has a position as violin faculty in Oberlin, but also at the Juilliard School, so she's kind of in between Oberlin and New York. And I myself now I'm based in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but also kind of commute with New York. So the trio has always been based in New York, and we just travel to make sure we always have that time in New York together.
And what's coming up ahead for you? I understand you have another tour coming in Asia. Is that still on, or has COVID impacted a lot of your touring plans?
Yeah, our touring plans have been very impacted by COVID. So we were supposed to do a 15 city tour last year. And so that has been, you know, kind of it's pending at the moment. We don't know when we'll be able to go. We were actually supposed to play in Sandali last year, and we were grateful that they rescheduled for this year. But yes, things are a little bit pending in terms of touring, but we have a lot of great projects coming up. And we look forward to just performing at Sandali. We've been there. I think it's going to be our third time, and we always love it there. So we're very excited to be back. We also played a concert at Bethelwood in the fall, which was also kind of part of the Chandelier Festival programmation. So we're just thrilled to be back to Chandelier.
Right, yes, yeah. I think I did hear you at the Play the Classics at Bethelwoods.
Oh, yeah,
yes,
wonderful.
It was great. Well, it sounds like you're going to be busy, and I'm sure you and all other musicians are going to be really happy when travel is much easier and safer for everyone.
Yeah.
And where can our listeners find out more about the trio?
You can find out more on our website, alicia-piano-trio.com, and we also have a Facebook page, Alicia Piano Trio. I think one thing that I might add about the trio and while we're called Alicia. Alicia is the concept of the Greek concept of sincerity, and it's something that we in our music making and with one another we really strive to embody. So that's why we chose our name, and it's been such a wonderful journey together since 2013, growing as musicians and as people, and I'm just really excited to share that program with you tonight.
Looking forward to the music. Thank you so much.
That's classical music host Kit talking to Juliet Erlen from the Alethea Trio, who will perform tonight the final concert of the Chandelier Music Festival, and we'll feature that tomorrow on Sunday Stage at 7. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. Farm and Country is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Support local news, info, and music. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.